I don't know if you remember from the vespers I had a few nights back that where I talked about knowledge, that you learn to know people by knowing them, not by knowing about them. And that when you read a novel or a story, these people become real to you, and you actually are acquainted with them in a perception that you wouldn't be if somebody were just, you know, telling you about them. You actually enter into a situation, the situation begins to happen to you, and you relate to that person. Now, I want to read you something that that Lewis says, C.S. Lewis says in his, this is The Shape of His Faith and Thought by Paul Homer. It's in the library. It was in the bookstore, I think, but I don't know if it's still there because I couldn't find any copies of it. But I took this out of Koinonia without any, you know, without any permission. But here is what Lewis says. If one comes to trust the somewhat, this is what Homer says about Lewis, if one comes to trust the somewhat crabbed notion that all knowing and all assurances must be via theories or laws, what is called sometimes the idea that knowledge must be propositional, then we have in Lewis's way of speaking savoir, or what Bertrand Russell called knowledge by description. As far as I can tell, C.S. Lewis never disparaged the zest for such, be it about whatever you please. But sometimes Lewis talks about knowing something by acquaintance, therein invoking the paralleling expression made familiar again by Russell. But he does not suppose the range of issues that Russell does, and he uses that expression without incorporating the whole theory that that philosopher had enjoined upon his readers. And what he's talking about as compared with this knowledge of by theory is that when you've actually become a part of a plot and you have begun to let that plot actually be your plot and not just something over here that you're reading here, you find that you begin to feel not like, you know, like Ted or Carla or Gretchen or Matt, or, but you begin to feel like that person, and you begin to identify with that person, so that you see something is happening to your, the stretching of your imagination, and also the depth of your perception and understanding of human beings as such, much more than if you were reading something about a, you know, sociologically about, now this is a, this case goes so and so, problem number five is such and such. This is what really used to bother me about psychology, when they talked about people as cases and problems. You know, they aren't. We aren't. Would you like to be referred to as a case? Mm-hmm. The burnt out or any other kind? Or would you like to be referred to as problem number 25 in some caseworkers, mm-hmm, or some teacher's notebook? You know, you don't really like that. Do you think anybody does? Of course not. But it's only when we begin to see and feel as individuals, and then feel ourselves into other situations, you begin this kind of experience called empathy, which happens through the imagination, working with the emotions and the intellect, to transfer your understandings into something actualized with another person. And this can happen in remarkable way. You can practice this kind of thing when you read novels, because you really do drop your blasted ego for a little while, and that's so much with us late and soon, and become a part of somebody else. And then the amazing thing is that this is why novels can become great escape literature. And as Tolkien says about escape literature, I think it's something you should remember, because when people will very often disparagingly refer to, well, you know, they just read that to escape from reality, that's all. Just nothing but escape. He says, you know, if people realize they're in prison, you know, is it so terrible if they start making up you know, ways of thinking themselves out of prison? Is it so terrible if they begin dreaming about what it might be like to live someplace else? Well, he said, in a real sense, you know, we're all in prison in this world. We are not all, you know, we're not all free to go and come as we might like. And novels, stories, poems, and lots of times other things, essays and even scientific experiments, can be an escape from the prison of where we are. I think it's a lot better to escape that way than to escape in some ways. It's a lot more damaging to the pocketbook and to the, and sometimes to the people in the family, such as alcoholism, which is also a very good escape for many people. But, of course, we never mention that in polite society. Oh. They always talk about, they talk about escaping in literature, because people that escape in literature, of course, never escape in bars. Usually people in bars never read books. That's the assumption, which is not true, because when you start reading about all the novelists and all the poets and where they spent their lives, a lot of it, and where a lot of them finally ended, you know, a lot of them did end in alcoholic stupors, I'm sorry to say. But not these people, fortunately, that we're reading about. They were none of them in that kind of an escapism. Their kind of escapism was an honest one of really trying to find, as Tolkien suggested, a way out of the prison so that you could get a vision and also a longing for the home that is outside, and that you begin to even think about the way in which heaven might be. And that's what some of the stories that you read, the novels that you read of both Lewis and Williams, and even some smatterings from some of the plays of Dorothy Sayers, and certainly some of the poetry gives you that kind of feeling. Tolkien too gives you a real sense of that. So don't let anybody, you know, talk you out of reading novels as if it were something that were, you have anything better to do but read a novel. I was just looking at a book at Chris's of a copy of pictures by Van Gogh, some prints of Van Gogh's, and I was telling her that when we were in Amsterdam at the Van Gogh Museum, Carol and I had seen this one floor that has glass cages with some of the actual still life material that Van Gogh used for his painting. And I said there was one that I just loved, and I could only get a little postcard of it, but I bought it for Carol because I thought it was so typical. It was this great big Bible, you know, with a candle next to it, and then here right next to it was a novel by Zola. I mean, the thing is, Carol's just, he really loves to read novels, and he also loves to read the Bible. And he never puts, I mean, and the thing is, the fact that the Bible was a lot bigger than the novel is quite typical also in Carol's life, because he does read the Bible over and over and over again, and he doesn't read novels over and over again, not the same one. But what interested me was the putting together of those two in one painting. And I think this is, it's a great combination if you can really soak yourself in scripture so that there is an authenticity about your life. Then when you read novels or fiction or whatever, in whatever form, there's a real human, what I mentioned, talked about is incarnational kind of feeling that comes to you as you move into the novels and the writings of people of your age or any other age, that makes the Bible, live in a different way too when you come back to it. Well, you'll be glad to know, I'm sure you've been worried about this, I did find the quotation that that Chris asked about, where this the Zoroaster quotation came from in the first chapter of the Descent into Hell. And I think most of you should have been aware of it because it is the first chapter. So you've most likely finished the first chapter. I would assume it. I'll read it to you just because I think you'll make your own deductions from it. But I did feel almost like Dorothy Sayers, one of her detective story writers, when I figured it out. I was going through this complete edition of Keats and Shelley, and Shelley, of course, has much more than Keats, which naturally would make it all the worse. And I thought, now, let's see, what, and I started going through, I went through the first lines and all. I thought, that isn't a first line kind of quotation. I thought, well, let's see now, dead child, maybe it's on death. Well, I looked through all the stuff on death, and no, it was the wrong kind of general style of writing. And I looked until my eyes were sore, and then I thought, well, I guess I'll just have to leave it. And I was going to go down and look up Zoroaster and see if I could find some clues, because I knew he was Persian, and I knew it was a Persian religion, and it had the conflict of light and dark and so on. But I thought, well, maybe there was something that would give me a clue to this myth. And all of a sudden, I opened the book today and I thought, I'll bet it's in Prometheus Unbound. What poem would this girl have been sent to memorize? She wouldn't have memorized some obscure little epitaph or something that was rather fragmentary. She would have had to memorize something that was important, something that her teacher, who was trying to discipline her, would consider as worth memorizing. And I thought, well, the biggest thing I can think of was Prometheus Unbound that Shelley wrote, and it covers an awful lot of territory, mythological in the Greek world, but also in other ways too. I was right. I was right, not because I knew so much English, but because I used my head. So you see, you can learn things every once in a while, even when you don't have anything to go on except common sense. So don't give up.
So it's Prometheus Unbound.
It's from Prometheus Unbound, and I'm going to read it to you, not the whole thing, because you'd be very delighted, I'm sure, to find out that you would not have any further discussion on the novel if I read Prometheus Unbound itself. About this long.
She had to memorize all that?
No. No. She only had to memorize one part of it. But, you see, when she did memorize that one part, I was thinking that she would have to memorize something that had some value and that would have something to do with the rest of the book. I mean, why would that book, why would that quotation, other than the fact that he saw himself coming, there must be something else, and there is. And somebody asked me about Battle Hill. Now, see if you can see the connection. Prometheus is talking to to the earth as his mother, and and he wants to know what kind of comfort, what kind of strength do people get who suffer, and what do they get from the earth? And the earth says this. They're going to find out the answers. They shall be told, ere Babylon was dust, the Magus Zoroaster, my dead child. And she's talking to Prometheus, by the way. So it wasn't Shelley's child that was dead. It was Prometheus, you see. Met his own image walking in the garden. That apparition, soul of men, he saw. For know, there are two worlds of life and death. One, that which thou beholdest, but the other is underneath the grave, where do inhabit the shadows of all forms that think and live, till death unite them and they part no more. Dreams and the light imaginings of men, and all that faith creates or love desires, terrible, strange, sublime, and beauteous shapes. And then she goes on to talk about a lot of other things, but this is the kind of the feeling that you get from this, from the descent into hell. That, you know, there are all these things that are going on all the time, and there are these desires that are being granted to Wentworth. There are these temptations that are being given to Pauline, as we'll see when we go through the some of the chapters today. And this is kind of a little, as if you were going to have a motif in some kind of a musical. Composition. It's going to sort of run through the whole poem, and it comes back in. She mentions it again, if you remember, later on in one of the chapters. But I want to just quickly go through these chapters, and I'd like to have you listen to some of these things that I'm going to mention, and we'll turn to some of the quotations. And then if there are questions that you have as we go, you may certainly stop me. Don't wait till the end of the hour and say, well, I do have one question. I mean, don't feel like you have to wait. I know it's hard, as I tell Carol, it's very hard for anybody to stop a moving express train when you're lecturing. He also says, now stop me. I mean, you know, you almost have to throw yourself in front of him. Well, I feel like that's sort of what you have to do with me, I'm afraid, when I get started. So, this is a little bit, it's a little bit slower because we are going to stop and look at these quotes. And so if you have questions, and if I can answer them, I will. And if I can't, well, we'll just have to look it up and see if we can find some answers that help us. The first chapter, remember, is the chapter that sort of gives you the feeling of what Pauline is up against in her life, this doppelganger, this person that comes and meets her, and her fright and her fear of that. It also sets the stage, literally, with this the fact that there's going to be a play and so on. Now, the next chapter is called The Way of Death, and we just looked at that a moment yesterday and talked about what Lawrence Wentworth was doing there, and also the fact that what Battle Hill was like, and we tried to bring out some of those things. I think some of you asked some questions about it.
Oh, you mean is this that must have a double meaning? That has a double. Because when I read that chapter, I just thought it was the suicide guy.
It is, but it's the beginning of Lawrence Wentworth.
That's also significant. Because he was on his way to death.
Yes, and he's also, you remember that the man that commits suicide, it's the house he hung himself from. The bedroom window is Lawrence Wentworth's bedroom window. You remember, that's quite a bit said about that. I think I read to you on page 26, but I think you should check that and underline it, because this book, when I reread it again, and I read it again today, I went over it again after, it must be four times or five times I read it. I should know it by heart, but I'm getting so old that I don't remember things very well. But this book, more than almost any of the others, I think, of Charles Williams' books, is really makes very clear the importance of social compassion and the fact that a kind of an immunized feeling over against the needs of the underdogs of the world, the people that have been stepped on and thrown around. And I think you could certainly underline on page 26 this the second paragraph on that page where it talks about what happens to this poor fellow, that the national margin of unemployment had been reduced by the new engagement of laborers, and from the work's point of view reduced in one instance unwisely. And that's when this particular fellow, a certain unskilled assistant, had been carelessly taken on. He was hungry, he was ill, he was clumsy and slow, his name no one troubled to know. He shambled among the rest, their humorous butt, and he was used to that. And then I said, I think I read this. Did I read this to you yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
That even repeatedly flung into the gutter by the turn of a hand in New York or Paris, and remember he didn't work in New York and Paris, but it was this continual, you know, recycling of jobs and a great more automation, more development, a change in management, all these things, and this one man is kind of a singular symbol of what happens to the workman for whom nobody cares. And he's dumped, and he says here he had lost his early habit of complaining and only added to his passive wretchedness that his wife kept hers. and that she made money, she made what money she could as a cleaning woman, and his life seemed to him an endless gutter down which ran an endless voice. And so he was, you know, he was discharged. And all the way through the book, I think you should pay attention to this. I wish you'd take a take your pencils or pens and check the note wherever it says something about the victimization of the poor, the fact that this or that person, particularly Lawrence Wentworth, paid no attention. It didn't make any difference to him whether people were out of work or unhappy or miserable. You know, that wasn't his business. And you remember perhaps when he's having this strange, weird affair with this being that is not a being but just a projection of himself, when this little man comes into his dream life, he says, "No, I don't want you here. I don't want anybody here. I don't want any beggars or canvassers, people that want help getting money for people who have palsy or what have you, you know. We don't answer the door. All deliveries made in the rear," and so on. That's the kind of thing that Lawrence Wentworth said. And there's another place in, Pauline is talking to Wentworth, and on page 45 in the next chapter, The Quest of Hell, when it begins to develop Wentworth's own peculiar personality, this paragraph, the first big paragraph on that page, I must say one thing, that Williams does have a lot of long paragraphs, and they sometimes are hard. You have to go back and read over them. Go back and find the beginning of the sentence and say, now, what was he really talking about? Because the way he writes, sometimes he gets such a poetic rhythm into it, it's like an incantation. And he repeats words like, almost like a Hebraic kind of style. But in this, on page 45, he says, "Mr. Wentworth, he missed out on having Adela and Hugh and all the other young people there. And Pauline is the only one that's coming to his little Thursday night gathering that they had been going to kind of regularly. He was sort of a patron, intellectual, light, and military historian, interesting, and not too old. And Pauline was the only one that was left. It left him tiresomely alone with Pauline. Pauline had a recurrent tendency to lose the finer point of military strategy in an unnecessary discussion of the sufferings of the rank and file." You see, I mean, you know, this is just another little, just, I mean, Williams doesn't make a big tirade on the needs of the socially deprived. But he lets you in to all these people and says, you don't have to think this, but you just get inside of these people for a while and let it happen to you. You know, start thinking this way. And then he says, "Not to reckon her companionship with men in grief, which incited her. He did not think he wanted to have to talk to Pauline, but he was pleased to think he need not carry Hugh's message to Adela. I skipped this one line that I meant to read. Neither of them knew that it was the comfort of his house and his chairs not to reckon her companionship with men in grief which incited her." I mean, the very plushy feeling she had about the kind of life that Wentworth lived entirely for himself and in a very, obviously egocentric way, and apparently, and her relationship with people who were in need that she had known, that this made her really question, what happens to all the ordinary soldiers when the officers are all planning all this? Where does the infantry go, you know? And he says, "That's not important. The important thing is the diagram. You've got to win the war, you see." And she says, "Well, you know, what about the people?"
So it was because of the contrast.
She knew that
were in grief.
Yeah, she had known people who had been in grief from a war, and she knew that people had been pushed around and shoved around because military people in offices and behind desks and plan things and shoved people around as if they were puppets with no feelings. And so she asked questions about that. Well, of course it bothered Lawrence Wentworth. He didn't like questions like that. Those were not important to the strategy of the military plans that he was making and that he was so proud of that he could handle. Well, anyway, we'll go back to the chapter, the second chapter on the death of the man who is hanging himself. What do you understand by the Republic? You know, Williams continually, in this chapter particularly, talks about the Republic. And he says, the Republic, of which he knew nothing, had betrayed him.
Where's that?
This is on the bottom of page 27.
Okay.
He got up and decided that he might as well, you know, he might as well finish his life. He said the Republic had betrayed him. All the nourishment that comes from friendship and common pain was as much forbidden to him as the poor nourishment of his body. The Republic had decided that it was better one man or many men should perish than the people in the dangerous chance of helping those many. It had, as always, denied supernatural justice. He went on in that public but unspectacular abandonment when the sun went down on him.
I was trying to figure out when that was in time.
Well, this was before when he was getting ready to hang himself. He was making the decision to die.
Yeah, but I mean when he lived.
Well, this man must have died. Because
it isn't historical.
No. And this is, I don't think this is Strother, you see. I don't think this is
Strother. I don't think so either.
And I assume that this man was part of the building of the suburban houses that were being developed on Battle Hill. You get no indication of an exact date.
The only thing would be the Republic one that was referred to as that.
Well, I think what you have to think about the Republic is this is the body politic. This is not a republic as such. It's not some big, you know, government. It's all of us. And the German, I mean the Latin word res publica, public affairs, public things. It's what makes up our societies. This is the Republic that Williams is referring to.
Mm.
He's not referring to a republic that is like a republican form of government or something like that. The Republic he refers to just as he refers to the city very often as a symbol of the city of God. The Republic is the way society is with a kind of a rough justice that has no real relationship with any kind of supernatural laws that would govern it for the benefit of anybody. I mean, it's just the majority, what the majority needs is what's usually best.
And so there wasn't a time when in like English history?
No, this is not this doesn't refer to the Republic. No, he talks about the Republic in other places as just simply a kind of a symbol of society, the way society operates. And you and I are just as much part of that as anybody. You know, and when Ronnie mentioned writing to your senators or your congressman about something, that's when you're part of the res publica, you're part of public things. If you want to get something done, you have to do it in the Republic. Otherwise, they'll just take over, whoever they are, will take over and do it any way that pleases them. And so the references that Williams makes goes back and forth in history in order so that when you start reading it and trying to keep track of all the illustrations that he is using, you really get dizzy. I do, and I sometimes have to. I skip a paragraph. I get as much as I can, and then I go on, and then I go back and see how do I fit that into the rest of it. But you can always have time to do that. So don't worry about it if you don't get all those things fitted in this time around. You can read Descent into Hell another time, you know. If you buy the book, you can keep it and reread it, and you'll find that you'll underline quite different things at another reading, like reading the Bible. let's see now.
Your thingy is here.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Then, on page 30, there's his concern about measuring out the rope. That it should be, he's very careful about finding out exactly how long that rope should be so that he wouldn't make a mistake and, you know, and drop down, and then suddenly he wouldn't be dead. He would just be injured, and there he'd be in their hands again. He wouldn't be free. So he really works hard to make it work right. And on page 31, I think it's really interesting the way Williams brings in the creed of Christendom. He says here that he didn't realize anything about that there isn't a dichotomy of flesh and spirit. I mean, as we know from talking about it before, these people, and Williams especially, was very concerned about the fact that body and soul were part and parcel of each other. They are not separated. There isn't a dichotomy. There isn't a fact that you know, that your body is something bad and your soul is what really belongs to God. I mean, that's what your spiritual life is, you know, in quotation marks. So he says on page 31 up there at the top of the page, William says, the unity of that creed, that there isn't a dichotomy, that flesh and soul are one, has proclaimed against experience, against intelligence, that for the achievement of man's unity, the body of his knowledge is to be raised. No other fairer stuff, no alien matter, but this, to be impregnated with holiness and transmuted by lovely passion perhaps, but still this. Scars and prints may disseminate splendor, but the body is to be the same, the very body of the very soul that are both names of the single man. The very body and the very soul. In other words, you are not divided, you know, into two. And when people refer to St. Paul saying, you know, the flesh wars against the spirit, I mean, the Lord says that, and the flesh is willing, but the spirit is weak. That doesn't mean, I mean, the other way around, spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That doesn't mean that necessarily assumes that you're not one piece. And when Paul says that I war against the flesh, it's the flesh meaning the part of you that is your ego, that is demanding to be first, which Lawrence Wentworth is the great example in this story, where, and the final destruction of his life is because his ego was allowed to make its final, its great refusal of God and its great affirmation of himself as being the only legitimate answer to anything. But I think it's important, and that you notice some of these things when you run through a novel like this, when you read it, that there's so much more in this novel than there is in a lot of novels that you can read certainly much faster. But there's a whole lot of stuff that just, you know, crunches around inside of your head and your mouth, and you know, you have to chew it over to digest it and understand it, and then you still have to go back to it. On page 33, another one of these little notes about the rich and compared with the oppressed, that upper part of the first part of that second paragraph there. Could someone out of the world that was filled with his rich enemies have come while he was down at the foot doing something he could not remember, and run up the ladder quietly and stolen back his rope as he himself had stolen it? I mean, that just that little, you know, a world that was filled with his rich enemies. I mean, that's all a man had was rich enemies. They all, that's all there was. And then down at, in the bottom, at the bottom of the page. This is something I don't know if you realize. You're young. You don't realize this maybe, but think about it. There had always been present to him, unrecognized but secure, man's last hope, the possibility of death. It may be refused, but the refusal, even the unrecognized refusal, admits hope. So it's the second to the last paragraph on 33. Without the knowledge of his capacity of death, however much he fear it, man is desolate. And you see what despair he's in, because he thinks he can't kill himself now, because he's lost his rope. Yes, he does. And Charles Williams was, you know, was a reader of Kierkegaard. That isn't why we're reading him, by the way, but we're reading him because he's a good writer. But he did read Kierkegaard for whatever good or bad that did for him.
Can I just add a little? I took an overdose of Kielsen once. And I've never been so disappointed when it didn't work.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's really a distress.
Yes, exactly what he's talking about here.
Disappointment.
Yeah, real disappointment. Yeah. And a feeling that you know, now are you going to be able to make it again?
Right.
You know? Fortunately, you didn't.
I didn't.
But I mean, that's right. Then you remember that the anomaly of this little part of the story is the man was already dead. You know, he's coming back and living through his experience, and he realizes, well, of course the rope isn't there, because he'd already swung from it. He'd already died, and now he's walking around. And he doesn't know exactly where he is. But he is in this kind of limbo between death and purgatory and heaven, where he's sort of in a little schooling period where something's going to happen to him, and he does. Something happens to him during the book. He's not, you don't even know his name, but you know who he is. You know, really know who he is as a person. Down on page 34, at the bottom of the page, he's really disturbed by all this way the world looks to him right now. He felt through all his new world the absence of men, the mere absence, therefore, of evil. The world which was to be represented there by the grand culture of Battle Hill could offer him, after his whole life, no better thing than that it should keep away. Justice, so far, rescued him. What more there was had not yet begun to work. What more there was had not yet begun to work. He wandered away over the hill. Now, one thing I have to remind you of, that is, you know, this is not the Bible. And I'm not imparting, you know, permanent truth to you that you're supposed to believe, you know, literally, word for word. And it says so there, so I know that this is what happens to you after death. No, this is fiction. And just because I sound so authoritarian when I talk doesn't mean that it's true. You know, you have to remember that this is a story. But unless you get into it with a feeling that it really could happen, you know, nothing's going to happen to us when we read it. You have to really have a suspension of unbelief, you know, so that you can enter into it. And some parts I really detest, and I guess The Quest of Hell is one of the ones I dislike that chapter very much. But I'm going to read a little part of the purgatory to you, so that you get a little bit of that, of what it is that that Williams is drawing on, and also so that you understand some of the feeling that there is in this whole book. This whole book is, you remember what I said about the threshold that the medievalists had at the threshold of consciousness, that they had these guardians or counselors at the threshold that kept them one way or the other from just following their instincts, their prime volitions. I'll bet you've forgotten it. It was just last week that I told you. You know, you can't remember everything. I know that. But try to remember.
Have a little confidence.
Well, no, I don't have a little confidence. I just know how little I remember. Of course, you're younger, so you have better brains. But I know that it's hard to keep everything straight. But this is important. That this concept of the threshold, the image of the threshold, is what is present in this descent into hell, because this is where the decision is being made whether or not people are going to descend into hell or whether they're going to go on the way up to paradise. And the decisions are made not in great revival meetings where they surrender their lives to God and from that time on everything is going to be fine. The decisions are made ethically in very small, almost casual places. Very, very minute little things that these people individually say in response to a demand made upon them. And we'll check into some of the things that Wentworth does and says that turn his life definitely so that he actually begins to slide literally down the rope that he is dreaming about.
Which he climbs brings,
well, but
he climbs down.
He climbs down, which I am surprised that William chooses, because I didn't think you could climb down. I thought you could only climb up.
You climb down. You can't slide down for very long. You burn your...
Is it all right to use the word climb for climbing down?
Mm-hmm.
I would believe that Williams would know, and I'm glad that you are backing him up.
Because you use knots too. So if there were knots, you'd have to climb. You couldn't slide.
No, I'm not worried about the sliding. I'm just worried about the word climb.
Sliding would be something beyond your own ability.
You're right.
And climbing is something.
Something you really are willing to do. Right. That's
a good
point.
It is
a good point.
Climbing does imply going up.
But climbing implies going up to me. And I've always understood that it was not correct to use it to climb down.
I guess you do climb down a ladder.
Yeah, you do.
We say that, but I remember a purist English teacher couldn't say that. But then, well, as I say, I believe in Charles Williams. I believe. But I mean, I really do think that he knows what he's saying. And I don't know why somebody, I got this into my head that you couldn't climb down. Well. Anyway, he does climb down, and I think it's very interesting what Don said about the fact that there is a decision, and Ted says that you have to pull down, or somebody, and you said knots, you know, there are all these things about a rope that indicates some kind of decision making, at least willing to do it. All right, well, let's look at chapter 3. This is important because of the fact that this is the part where remember, this is the chapter I dislike so much. The part I dislike so much is the return to Eden, where he runs into this, where he makes this woman, she really turns me off. But, well, she should, you know, she's so evil, naturally. She would turn a good person like me off, but I'm sure she turns anybody off that is rational. You see, she would have probably turned Wentworth off too if he hadn't been in such a dream state. But it's because he was at the beck and call of the siren, and that's part of the purgatory that we're going to read in a minute. But I want you to look at page 35 what it says about Wentworth as a characterization. The second paragraph. He had known war. He had served with some distinction. He'd held a minor position on an army staff. And he had been alert at moving masses of men about and fitting them in and removing them again. He could not win battles, but he could devise occupation for armies. He could always, when necessary, find somewhere for them to go and something for them to do. And he could deal with any objections to their going or doing that were raised. His mind reduced the world to diagrams, and he saw to it that the diagrams fitted. Now, it's really a good little, I mean, it's just a good characterization of a man without telling him what color his hair is, or where he went to school, or what kind of parents he had, which is what we always have to know. You know, well, what was the man, what were his parents like? You know, we've got to know something about his heredity, his environment. Williams doesn't bother about that. He says, look at the man in the situation he's in. How does he act? How has he been acting? This is what is going to determine the way he's going to go. So he feels just like Becker does about sui causa, that you are your own cause. You know, it's true you come with a freight of stuff from your parents and your genes and whatnot, but the threshold of ascent is where you take up the decision to do something with it. And it's all these things that you're doing. And you see his willingness to move people around as if they were nothing, you know, just blocks, because they were fun, they were diagrams. So he could see why Caesar and Napoleon had done what they had done and how, but it was not to be expected that he could have seen it as they did before it happened. You see, he's a very good person for a, what we call a bench warmer, or these people are always can tell you how a football game should have been played after it was played. You know, they sit around. What do you call those people? I can't remember. No, but anyway, it's very typical.
Sideline.
That's right. It's the sideline coaches and the kind of thing that they are able to always tell. You know, what should have been done, why. On page 38, do people have to go and work already?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dear, that's too bad.
What time do you have?
I have 25 after. 3. It's a good thing we started at 2:30.
Yeah. We did.
25 minutes to 3. But we'll keep going on, but we will get into it tomorrow again. So. On page 38, his relationship with Aston Moffat, the historian, I think by the way in which this Moffat is described, you get a real sense of the kind of person Wentworth is not. You see what I mean? I mean, by describing that Moffat was a military historian who really loved history and scholarship for what it was. What, Arne, don't you have to work?
She won't let us go.
Cool. Carol, she going to go and work for you?
I guess.
One for the price of 3?
She's
going to
go tell him.
She's going to go tell him that we're
not going to
be there.
I know.
Oh, well, that's all right. She's got an in with the cook. So whether you like it or not, you're going to have to stay and listen. I think it's all right. I think it's a good thing you can stay, because and the reason I'm taking so long on all these parts is that I know that I had a hard time reading Charles Williams the first time I read him. It really was a nutcracker for me, and it may not be for you, because I think you've got a little bit more maybe going in the present, your present conversation, that helps you to understand him. But and I hadn't read The Inferno immediately before reading it, so I didn't have that either, but still, I think he's not all that easy. And but now see what Aston Moffat, what Williams says about Moffat, and the fact that, see, Moffat is a historian, a very scholarly man, who is Wentworth's great enemy, because he feels like he's a rival. And the interesting thing is that Wentworth is younger than Moffat. But Wentworth you see, wants it for himself. And Moffat really loves history. Just really loves history. See the difference?
There's a little line in there that's still... Yeah. He says he had determined his nature.
Yeah.
You know, that's just...
Where's that? Page...
38? That's not what you're talking about.
Yeah,
Moffat.
Yeah, right. He... And that's down in...
It's right in the middle of the page, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right below where it finishes talking about Moffat, it says that he was by now almost 70. He derived a great deal of intellectual joy from expounding his point of view. He was a pure scholar, a holy and beautiful soul who would have sacrificed reputation, income, and life, if necessary, for the discovery of one fact about the horse boys of Edward Plantagenet. Well, you know, you think that is kind of putting it to the very end. But... On the other hand, he had determined his nature. He was the kind of person he was, and he would never have been dishonest about anything. I mean, he would have been accurate, and you know, he would never think of putting his reputation up if he thought that if he had made a mistake, he would have said so. Not so Wentworth. He made mistakes on purpose so that he could increase his reputation if he thought it could be done. Wentworth was younger and at a more critical point. At that moment, when a man's real concern begins to separate itself from his pretended. When a man's real concern begins to separate itself from his pretended concern. You see, he was supposedly a military historian of great note and very, you know, very smart. And of course history was his great thing. But that was not his real concern. And almost to become independent of himself. He raged secretly as he wrote his letters, and this, remember, is against Moffat, and drew up his evidence. He identified scholarship with himself and asserted himself under the disguise of a defense of scholarship. He refused to admit that the exact detail of Edward's march was not, in fact, worth to him the cost of a single cigar. Bad he mentioned cigars. Tender point in our family, but then... But you see, you get this very... And over on page 39 in the middle, toward the middle of the first, in the first paragraph there, he says how he was doing this. He's going to answer the letter that Aston Moffat had written in the paper. And it was difficult. He was beginning to twist the intention of the sentences in his authorities, preferring strange meanings and awkward constructions, adjusting evidence, manipulating words. In defense of his conclusion, he was willing to cheat in the evidence, a habit more usual to religious writers than historical.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
That's
crazy. True. True, too, because mostly, you know, religious people... Religious writers very often have a real heavy bone to pick, and they'll sometimes fix up things to suit because they.
That's something
awful.
People who are supposed to care most about the truth.
Yeah, right. But he was still, and this is a marvelous image. But he was still innocent enough to be irritated. You see, he was still not gone. He could have changed his decision. He still hadn't moved the threshold of assent. You see. Had not been given over to the negative. He felt, as it were, a roughness in the rope of his dream. You know?
I don't understand that.
Well, you know, that rope that he had as a nightmare, you know, it wasn't all that comfortable. And it was, you know, and he was going down on it. And the irritation was, you know, he felt that. Now, you know, how did he feel it? Who knows? But it's just simply the image that the nightmare was to him a warning. You see, there's a warning there. And it was still moving on him. He was still getting the irritant from it instead of saying how slippery, how lovely, how easy it is to move down. You know? And this is quite a neat little thing. And then of course his discussion with Adela and Hugh is quite funny, and And then you remember how he, I don't know how many of you have had this experience of being really jealous of somebody, but he stands out there and wonders, should he or shouldn't he? Should he watch for them or shouldn't he? Does he want to see them? Doesn't he? No, I don't want to see them. Yes, I do want to see them. I don't want them to see me. Yes, I do want them to see me. You know, just sort of, and the wonderful way Williams puts it is, see, the shadow provoked him. He heard footsteps again. Remember what he said, that there were footsteps all the time through this book? This is the footsteppiest book I've ever read. And the shadow provoked him. In it, they might be now passing the end of his road. He must act before it was too late. He would not go to spy. He would go for a walk. He went out of the room, down the street. And then he says, he went out of the room, down the soft, swift stairs of his mind, into the streets of his mind, to find the phantoms of his mind. He desired hell. That's on page 50. I'm sorry, I didn't. I got so excited about what he was doing. Above that, on page 50, you have a feeling that a remnant of intelligence cried to him that this was the road of mania and self-indulgence leading to mania. Self-preservation itself urged him to remain, not to go out and, you know, just rub salt in his wounds. But in his mind, he starts thinking, oh, but I really want to do this. I really want to find out. I have to find out. I'm going to find out. And so he did. But first, he goes through it in his mind. And that's where he desires hell. So you don't make your big decision to go to hell by, you know, immediately plunging into some terrible temptation. You've already faced it in your mind. You know, it's really something.
Yeah.
It's true, too. I mean, I haven't been to hell yet, but I mean, I know it's true that this can happen and that you do face temptations in your mind. And this also allows you to change your mind, thank goodness. So you don't always have to go jumping into something.
The thing that's so neat here is the way William shows the warnings.
Yes, to, right. You know. There are warnings all the way. His own intelligence warns him. His own self-preservation warns him.
And that if we're just open to that, we
yeah.
do see.
Yeah.
We are given the sight to
exactly.
It.
Oh,
this
and
is what's going to drive me crazy.
And I think this image is really good here, too, on page 51, where he says, when he's walking back and forth, and he's just exhausted. But the exhaustion postpones our complete damnation, but it doesn't save him. He wasn't overtired, but he paced and repaced cannibal of his heart. Now you get the feeling that really he was chewing himself out. You know, he was eating out his heart, waiting for somebody to come and prove to him that they had been doing what he thinks they had done, which is just going to make him miserable. I mean, why not let it be not known? And he could have, you know, gotten along much better. At least he would have had a night without worrying or feeling miserable. But instead of that, as the cannibal of his heart, he just ate himself out with jealousy and insisted that he had to feel totally sorry for himself because he was going to see them walking together if he had to. If he possibly could, and of course he did, didn't he?
Well,
actually,
he talked about us.
You're right. That's true. I think that's really a good point. And it's exactly where... And this is, you see, the thing is, he doesn't say this. You know, if somebody preached this to you, you know, you might listen to it and say, yeah, that's right. You know, wow, I'll do something about that.
Boy, that other person I know ought to listen to that.
Yeah, right. But you get into it, and you all of a sudden you begin to see, this could be me. Not that I'm Wentworth, but I have my own kinds of systems, and I've got my own kinds of rationalizations, and I have my own kinds of warning systems, like the computer thing we were looking at, you know, the little red bell that goes on. they're not that obvious. But all of us have, every one of us has warning systems built in some way or other, or that the Holy Spirit can use to get at us, whether it's nightmares or people or situations that, you know, scratch us and say, hey, you sure you want to do it that way?
And the reason it's so effective way it is because, at least for me, I was so disgusted with money before I ever saw that I'd do the same thing.
He really is. That's true. Well, and partly the reason that he is so terrible to you is that you see him in his absolute category of descent. You see, most of us don't see ourselves or anybody else in any place but on the threshold, fortunately. You know, because we are not to judge. We can't judge people. But in a novel, you see, this is possible for an author to allow a person to go into the whole way so he can slide down the whole way down the rope. See, this isn't going to happen to us in a community. You can't say to somebody, I know that person is going to hell. I mean, if you do, you're probably going to hell with him. Because the one thing the Lord said we couldn't do was just exactly that. But as Dante, you remember, says, nobody goes to hell that doesn't want to go there.
Yeah, and there's that line about Wentworth, too, further on, about how Pauline had wanted help out of her fear, but he did not want to make that decision.
He didn't. No, he didn't, and he doesn't. And at first, Pauline, you remember, doesn't want help because it bothers her self-respect. Remember when she talks
to Peter? But she really did want to get rid of
him. When she talks to Peter Stanhope, and she said, really, I shouldn't ask. Why should I ask you to do that? I can't do that. I couldn't feel right about it. And he says, look, are you making the laws of the universe or what? He really gets it across to her right away. Don't be such a phony. This isn't up to you. If you really want help, you better take it the way it's given. And that's what you get in the chapter on the doctrine of substitute love.
I was so disgusted with the way the games going on between Wentworth and Hugh and Adela.
Well, that was a real game too, on the part of all of them.
They were using each other for their own flattery.
Exactly.
And for their own game. Oh.
And this is one reason.
And that Hugh and Adela weren't just playing against.
Playing with each other.
You bet.
That's right. Yeah. That's the way it is. One of the good things about the book is that although it deals with all these, they're eternal truths and they're universals and they're, theological convictions all the way through, but they are enfleshed. See, they're incarnate. You aren't dealing with just ideas. These are real people. And it's true they're maybe not as real to you as some people in some other novels, because they're not in the same, for one thing, they're not in the same area that you and I live in, and they have their conversations are really funny, especially Stanhope. He really does speak like a theological poet, and not somebody that's used to dealing with children people just who just want things straight from the shoulder and not put in images or something like that. But on the other hand, you do have people like Adela and Hugh and Mrs. Perry, who are right there, and Myrtle Fox. They're all just exactly where they're at, I did discover, remember Mrs. Samuel that we talked about? When I was rereading The Purgatory, I think I'll just check on the notes in this canto a little bit. And I hadn't looked at Dorothy Sayers' notes for this particular canto where it talks about the siren. And I discovered that Lilith, well, of course her name was Lily, Lilith, who is in the Garden of Eden and is the mythical, she isn't in the Bible either. She's a storied person who supposedly was a phantom of of Adam's mind, and that's why the Lord decided he better get a help meet for Adam. And you know, it's not a help mate, but it's a help meet for him, the kind of help he needed. Not an animal, but certainly not a phantom. Well, of course, you know, this wasn't in the scriptures. I mean, that is, the phantom wasn't. But Lilith is in all these old stories and myths about creation. And Lilith is a real slippery person, just like Mrs. Samuel is, and just like the Adela figure that Wentworth projects out of his mind. It's simply a projection. She was a projection of Adam's mind, a fantasy. And she was actually produced for Adam and his mind by a figure in that mythology called Samael. So you get Lily Samael for a name for this gal.
Wow.
Isn't that funny? I mean,
that's amazing.
I'm sorry that I hadn't checked that out before.
Where do you read about that kind of stuff?
That's in Dorothy Sayers. She is an encyclopedia, you know, of knowledge. And in her notes to the 19th canto, where she explains the siren, who is the, you know, the voice that comes in and talks to Wentworth when Wentworth makes up this terrible creature that lives with him from that time on, and finally actually kills him. And this is what Dorothy Sayers says, is that she is at first sight unattractive. She only acquires strength and beauty in the inferno from Dante's own gaze. She is therefore the projection upon the outer world of something in the mind. The soul, falling in love with itself, perceives other people and things not as they are, but as wish fulfillments of its own. Its love for them is not love for a true other, but a devouring, egotistical fantasy. You see? And this is exactly what Wentworth's projection of this really repulsive creature was when he talks about Return to Eden. And you remember that the same Lily Samuel, the same Mrs. Samuel, comes to visit the grandmother, and she really tries to get Pauline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she says, you know, I can satisfy your dreams. I can give you so much goodness. You don't have to think about anything bad anymore. You know, it's just really an ooze of sweetness coming out that you know can't be real. But if somebody is really hurting, you know, that kind of stuff really, you know, really just flows over them, and they feel like, wow, could this person really help me that much? And
like putting a salve on an infected wound instead of cleaning it out.
Sort of like that, exactly. It could be. The vision of death, which is chapter 4, is the story of the grandmother. And you know, that is really some image. The grandmother actually goes through her own death in the chapter, and you get the feeling of this strange, almost physical experience that she has as she crawls over the mountain and sees all this strange kind of terrain that is part of Battle Hill and yet is not Battle Hill. There aren't any houses there anymore. And
she is the mountain.
It's really, she becomes the earth itself, you know, such as she says. Well, over here on page 53, I really like the one thing that Pauline says about her family. She's really, her uncle decided that she should go and live with her grandmother because, well, her grandmother, Pauline's mother, had never liked her husband's parents. The girl had practically never seen the old lady. But the blood relationship in her uncle's mind connoted intimacy, and he found an occupation for an orphan and a companion for a widow at one stroke of mercy. So the uncle felt very good. He was doing something very fine for an orphan, Pauline, for his mother, whom he didn't want to take care of. And they could live together. How lovely. You know, and he was the one that was doing such a good job.
I wonder if he's descending into hell.
Well, fortunately, we don't have to follow him. Pauline was furious at the decisive kindness which regulated her life. I really like that. Decisive kindness that regulated her life. You know, that's the way I do that so much, and mothers very often do. And they always have such good kind of decisive kindness about what they're going to do for their children. Well, I think you should do it this way. Don't you think that would be a good idea? Well, you know, by the time you get through talking to any of your kids, you know, they just say, well, what's the use of arguing? You know, she's got it all figured out, even if I don't want to do it. And then, on page 53, she has, oh, I'm sad that some of your mothers must be like this, but page 53, I just love this, that Pauline was really good, you know, she was a really good girl, and she says here, the grandmother made no demands on her granddaughter, towards whom indeed she showed a delicate social courtesy. And you know, this is one thing you can be aware of all through the book, that for Williams, courtesy was extremely important, even when it meant, like when Stanhope is talking about the way he wants his play read. He wants it read speedily. And it's interesting that so did Dante. That's the way Dante wrote the Purgatory. It had to be read with speed. It was written with speed, and the beat is speedy. Well, Stanhope wanted his play read with speed. But when Pauline talks to him about he says, well, I'd like to have it that way, but, you know, we don't want to make too much of that. You know, let them do it the way it, you know, so they enjoy it. And you know, this is something that you have to, there's a balance between when it's a matter of real conviction that you have to come right out with and pound the floor with, and when really you have to be tactful and not intrude too much, because it isn't going to make that much difference anyway. It takes a little intelligence, you know, to be a Christian. You don't just, you know what the truths are and shout them out as loudly as you can. Now, there has to be a kind of an empathy and a delicacy in the way in which you deal with people around you. And this is what is also very apparent here. The grandmother showed a delicate social courtesy towards her granddaughter, and Pauline in turn, though in a harsher manner, maintained towards her a steady deference and patience. The girl was in fact so patient with the old lady that she had not yet noticed that she was never given an opportunity to be patient. Did you get that?
I have a hard time with that.
Well,
I put a question mark there.
She endured her own nature and supposed it to be the burden of another's. Her grandmother was anything but impatient, but Pauline was so busy thinking that she was being patient, and she was so full of her own goodness and her own patience as a virtue, that it was an actual burden to her to be patient. And the grandmother was just being really delightful and courteous and never bothered her, but Pauline was sure that she was being patient, and she was being a good granddaughter to her and everything like that. When really, she wasn't being, there was no demand being made on her.
So there was no need to be patient.
Well, no, because, well, you see, the thing is that patience as a so-called virtue was not being demanded of Pauline, because the virtue was all in the grandmother. She was being pleasant and delicate and courteous and all that sort of stuff that Williams talks about. And, you know, who has to be patient with somebody that's that nice? But Pauline was so busy thinking about herself and her troubles that she knew she must be really patient. She was not aware of the fact that there wasn't any need for it. You think about that. Over on page 54, the grandmother again. She's talking, you know, she asked Pauline about taking part in the play, and she's really concerned that if she dies, that Pauline should just go right ahead and act in the play anyway. She wants to be sure that this is cleared up before her death. Pauline thought it might be the hot afternoon that gave the voice that effective distance. It was clear, but small, and from afar. The words, the tone, were affectionate with an impersonal love. Pauline thought, She might be talking to Phoebe. Phoebe being the maid. And at the same time realized that Mrs. Anstruther did so talk to Phoebe and to everyone. Her goodwill diffused itself in all directions. Her granddaughter lay in its way with all things besides, and it mingled with the warm sun in a general benediction. Good little description of the way in which the grandmother related to people. She was a real, gospel grace person that just flowed out to people. She was as nice to her maid as she was to her grandmother. Now, you might not want that to happen if you happen to be the granddaughter or the grandson, but nevertheless, in the equality of grace, that's essential.
That's careful.
Yep. And then down on page 55, the grandmother reads about, she's talking to Pauline about her approaching death, and she says, Pauline says, I thought you'd been stronger lately since the summer came in. I have a journey, sir, shortly to go, Mrs. Anstruther quoted, and a quieter starting place than our ancestor. And then Pauline suddenly remembers, oh, but I remember, he was martyred, wasn't he? And then she quotes this really wonderful little story from George Fox's Martyrs, which is a book of martyrs of the Anglican Church. And all these little statements in there that are italicized are things that stick in Pauline's mind, and particularly the last one, I have seen the salvation of my God, because that becomes a sort of a battle cry that runs through Pauline's mind, and what finally, when she herself sees the salvation of her God, she's able to say it too, when she identifies with her ancestor. Okay, well, tomorrow I hope we can finish the descent into hell.